This is WCNY's The Capitol Press Room, and we're joined remotely by New York Home and Community Renewal Commissioner Ruth Ann Visnauskas, who's back with us to talk about some of the major housing policies in the recently adopted state budget. Welcome back to the show, Commissioner.
Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you on this important topic. So a major focus for the governor heading into budget negotiations with the state legislature was to take steps in this budget that would create new housing opportunities in the future. So what in this package is there that you think will make a meaningful dent in that goal of new home creation?
Thanks for the question. It's certainly one that we have been talking about for the better part of 2 years now, as we've been proposing unsuccessfully in this process, a series of tools that we need to increase supply of housing across the state, both leading up to the budget being done and now in sort of the post-budget talking about it, and still in some ways overwhelmed to sort of tick through the list of things that have come out of this budget, which is for our purposes, we are tracking about 15 different things, and there's more than that even, but those are sort of the high level ones we are tracking. So really delighted to have some new tax incentives to spur production of mixed income housing in New York City and rest of state. So we have a replacement for the old 421A program called 45X, which will create permanently affordable mixed income rental housing in New York City, and include affordable units that are oftentimes hard to produce, especially in our sort of high market areas in New York City. Also a extension for the old 421A program. So projects that were stalled can now start again and they have a longer time to complete. And there's a couple other tools in there, including a tax exemption for commercial conversion, so office buildings that want to become residential, as well as removing a cap on the residential density in certain parts of New York City. So in really a lot of things that folks have been talking about for a very long time, as I sort of said, having a couple unsuccessful years of people coming together and the legislature being able to sort of get over finish line. So really excited to be here today with so many policy tools in our hands.
Well, let's talk about the extension, so to speak, of 421A, which is going to have a new form as part of this budget, in addition to carrying on 421A for some projects. There was discussion about the form that a tax incentive would take, with some criticism about the potential benefits of an abatement versus an exemption. What is the form of incentive that was ultimately settled on in the budget, and what are your expectations for it?
Certainly, our expectations are that it's going to catalyze tens of thousands of new rental apartments, and at the same time, assure that at least 25% of all the apartments that are built in those buildings are going to be permanently affordable to low and moderate income families. That's really the big headline, and it's a big deal, right? Building new apartments for low and moderate income families without sort of direct public subsidy is a big deal. We, as you know, have a housing plan that we are operating under, where over a course of 5 years, we will create and preserve 100,000 units of affordable housing across the state. And the new program 45X is all incremental to that. So in addition to the work that we are doing with capital subsidy, this is a non-direct subsidy way for new mixed income rental housing to get built. And so we think it's really one of the most powerful tools, both to create the housing as well as to make sure that housing is built in desirable neighborhoods that oftentimes is out of reach for low-income families. So we're excited to have this tax incentive in place. We also believe, just sort of switching to the commercial conversions tax incentive, that, you know, in the case there, people can convert office buildings to residential in some parts of New York City, and the mayor's team is working to expand that. But what we did through this budget was say, here's a tax incentive. And when you go through that conversion, we'll give you a tax incentive if you also set aside units in those buildings for low and moderate income families. So again, sort of a win to make sure that as housing is getting built or as office buildings are getting converted, that that includes affordable housing everywhere that that's happening.
There's been a lot of talk in recent years about the conversion process and the potential for creating new housing through converting, say, office space into housing. We haven't actually seen that materialized to date due to some of the barriers to doing this. And that's not just cost, which you're addressing with the tax incentive, but there's just logistical challenges as well. So does the standalone tax incentives on this front address all of the outstanding concerns you have, or does more need to be done to help facilitate those conversions?
So in at the same time that this process was happening, there are also large changes in New York City to the zoning happening, and the Adams administration is putting forward a City of Yes for Housing proposal, which is going to make changes that will facilitate more office buildings being able to convert to residential. So the tax incentive here in the state budget will really complement the zoning work that's getting done at the local level by the mayor and his team.
You mentioned in your initial answer that there's incentives for upstate as well. What is coming to the communities, say, north of the five boroughs, depending on where your definition of upstate is?
So there certainly is a lot in here for upstate, including a couple new tax exemptions. So there is an opt-in exemption. So this is for localities to adopt locally an exemption for 100% affordable housing. There's an exemption proposed for mixed income rental housing. And there's a tax exemption proposed for accessory dwelling units to allow homeowners who want to take advantage of building a granny flat or an ADU or a small home or whatever word you want to use for that on their property to have a tax benefit for doing that and sort of ease the burden of, obviously it costs homeowners money to create those units, and this would allow them some benefit from the tax burden that creates for them too. So there's a couple different tax exemptions for upstate as well.
Well, before we move on, let me reintroduce you for listeners just joining the Capitol Press Room. We're speaking with New York Home and Community Renewal Commissioner Ruth Ann Wisnauskas. So the governor has billed the adopted housing creation language in the budget as extraordinary in terms of its scope. So I'm interested in how it compares in terms of expected units over the next decade to what was unsuccessfully pushed last year, which offered the promise of 800,000 new homes over a decade.
So there's a lot of housing production sort of built in here, and each of the sort of policy tools that we reference will increase supply, all of them sort of in different ways. But certainly we've seen the old 421-a program, which produced over 70,000 units over the last decade, is really a prime tool to create housing going forward. These are public-private partnerships, but they rely on the private sector to be creating the units. So we don't obviously have exact estimates on what we think it will produce going forward. We really just look at the past. But between 485X, the 421-a extension, commercial conversions, removing the FAR 12 cap, some upstate tax exemptions, there was some additional language in the budget around pro-housing communities, and we are still very front and center working on that, which is also intended to create more housing and reduce barriers to the creation of housing at the local level. And there's additional language in the budget on that too. So we think while this is not the entire package that we had last year, a lot of these things were part of it and were housing creation aspects of last year's plan that we are really happy got included this year and can kind of clear the way for the discussion about other tools.
But do you have a projection in mind for the next decade based on this budget?
We believe that this will add at least another 100,000 units over the next decade based on where we were before. And our hope is that this isn't the only housing package that will get done in the next decade. So other things will happen that can incrementally help us get to that projection that we talked about last year.
And when you say 100,000, would that be on top of the projected 400,000 units that might get built if the state had done nothing?
I think that some of these tools, which are new, would be something that last year was not in play as a requirement for localities to access state funding, and we think that's going to lead to pro-housing communities, as it were, really working to reduce barriers to get additional housing built. So we definitely think there are opportunities. In addition, the governor announced funding for housing on state-owned land, so up to 15,000 units that can get built on state-owned sites across the state. There's some funding for a new middle-income rental and home ownership program called Housing for Futures. So there are lots of programs in here that will be incremental to the 400,000 that would otherwise have happened that we talked about last year, for sure.
Well, what is the status of the effort to incentivize communities to make some local decisions that promote the growth of housing?
So, as you heard after sort of last year's budget in session, we got a lot of calls for communities to talk about more carrots and less sticks. And so the governor came out with a series of policies last summer, one of which was this Pro Housing Communities program, which basically said there's $650 million of funding that goes to municipalities around the state, and we are going to prioritize that funding to localities that are pro-housing communities. So a pro-housing community is a community that's either growing, and we have some sort of metrics and targets around what we mean by that, or if they aren't growing because there isn't demand, then they can pass a local resolution that reflects a commitment to housing growth, and that's around sort of reducing barriers and being affirmative about wanting to grow their housing stock. And so we have been working with localities around the state to get qualified for that. And the idea had been last year and as of last summer to prioritize funding for those communities. Fast forward to now, the change is that the $650 million at the state level is now only for communities that are certified pro-housing.
Well, sticking with the implementation of the pro-housing policy initiative, is that something where you're going to see communities adopting policies as early as this summer? And will some of the financial incentives begin to flow as part of this fiscal year? Or is that something that has a longer timeline?
Yes, absolutely. And we have been, I don't have an exact count where we are today, but we have been certifying communities. We have, I think, between 100 and 200 communities that we're currently actively working with to get their materials in and to get them certified. So we really have a lot of interest across the state. And one of the reasons for that is, you know, the funding programs start around this time of year and continue through the balance of this year. So it will be meaningful for communities as of today and going into the future. So we're really excited about that.
And after a quick break, we'll have more on the housing creation and tenant protection language included in the recently adopted state budget with New York Home and Community Renewal Commissioner Ruth Ann Visnauskas.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by Resorts World New York. With over 1 million square feet of space to play, relax, and celebrate, Resorts World New York City hosts more than 5 million visitors a year. That makes Resorts World a significant social and economic partner for local businesses and residents alike. Through its operations and outreach programs, Resorts World has generated more than $4 billion for the state educational system and 1,400 jobs for the people of Queens. More information at rwnewyork.com.
For listeners just joining us, we're continuing to unpack the housing creation and tenant protection language in the recently adopted state budget. And our guest is New York Home and Community Renewal Commissioner Ruth Ann Visnauskas.
So a variety of housing stakeholders, including the Real Estate Board of New York, have poo-pooed the potential of the housing creation initiatives in the budget. Not to say that they won't work, but maybe not to the scope of which the proponents think they might actually do. Only time will tell who is actually right. But I'm curious, what are the early indicators that you'll be looking for to judge the impact of what was adopted? Are there signs that will tell you in 2024, 2025, the actual impact of this?
So I would say a couple of things. One, as you know, sort of the building process, whether in New York City or in the rest of the state, is a long one, right? It takes a long time to get local entitlements, and it takes a long time just to get sort of shovels on the ground. And then it takes a year or 2 years or 3 years to build buildings and then get them leased up and rented. So it's a long game for sure. And as we talked about previously, when we talked about the crisis that we're in today, it is not a crisis of the last 12 months or the last 24 months, right? This was really sort of like a decade in the making when we look at housing production in the suburbs around New York City and in New York State overall. We see how we are slower and behind sort of on a per capita basis than New Jersey and then Connecticut and then many other cities across the country. So we would not expect a crisis that was born out of a decade to be solved in a year or two. However, and many of the programs and policies that were enacted in the budget are decade-long programs. So they will be here for the long term so that we can see the production, we can see that production actually happen. That said, you know, building permits are something that we can see on a year-over-year basis. We saw a huge drop last year in building permits. And so we would be able to see fairly quickly, I think, in the data over the course of the next 12 months, how permit data looks, certainly in New York City as it relates to the 421A extension and the new 45X program. Those policies are impacting actual production. So I think it's both a short-term yes and also a very much a long-term yes.
Well, turning to tenant protections and efforts to keep New Yorkers in their apartments more broadly, The state budget does not include a proposed housing access voucher program that has been championed by both progressives as well as some in the real estate industry. And it doesn't include the language that's in the so-called good cause eviction legislation that's been floating around dealing with eviction protections and de facto rent caps. That being said, the sponsor of the good cause eviction legislation in the Senate, when explaining her vote, did describe the tenant protections that are being implemented as part of this budget as historic in nature. So I'm curious, from this budget, what stands out to you in terms of helping those New Yorkers who are struggling to afford their apartments or outright can't pay for a reasonably priced place right now?
I would say that the list of things that are included in the budget is 10 times longer than the list of things that are not in the budget. There is a lot in here. You know, there are things that in any other year, were it deed theft or insurance discrimination or the basement pilot program, like these are all big, great things. They kind of fall a little bit to the bottom of the list because we're getting overshadowed by things like 45X and 421A and commercial conversions. But there is a lot in here. I think I would say in terms of tenant protections, really excited that there is going to be protection for the unregulated, you know, basically market rate stock in New York City. So it's going to provide protections to renters who are otherwise not covered by any existing laws. And so in terms of price gouging and in terms of your landlord having to have a, you know, can't just sort of have a no cause for not renewing your lease and getting some real protections in there and getting that law on the books in the state of New York, it's effective as of the date the bill was passed. So this is something that protects people tomorrow and the next day, which is great for New York City and great for renters.
Well, how do you envision these protections actually being enforced? Because there are a lot of caveats and loopholes and exclusions that apply to it. And you probably need a law degree or spend time in HCR to understand it all. So how do you envision this being successfully implemented?
I think people will understand that there's a fairly clear metric for what a rent increase can be. So that is CPI plus 5%. Granted, not everybody knows what CPI is, but it's easy to look it up, or 10%, whichever is lower. So there are some clear ways for people to understand if their rent is going up higher than that, that they may be covered. And so that may not apply to them. And I think a lot of this will happen in the course of people who feel that they're being sort of unjustly evicted and will give them another way to defend that in court. So certainly understand that not all laws are easy for people to follow. But in this case, if you live in a, you know, in a 10 unit or more building, it will be clear. If your rent is going up by more than what's allowed by law, that will be clear. And both, as is often the case with these things, both advocates and we as government will be providing clarity on this so that people can understand whether they're protected or not.
Well, if someone does want to go to court outside of New York City to protect their rights, if a locality actually does opt in to some of these protections and that person knows that they're in a building covered by these new tenant protections, is there also going to be an issue of not accessing legal counsel? Because that's already a struggle in areas where there is that guaranteed right to counsel.
You know, I think that we work with a really large network of legal service providers and housing counsel providers across the state who, both in New York City and the rest of the state, really do work day in and day out to make sure that renters understand their rights and also have protections when they go into court. There was some additional eviction prevention funding that was provided in the budget that will go to those legal organizations to make sure that they can continue to provide that service. And there's a lot to be said for sort of communication and outreach, which the, you know, housing advocacy network across the state is really quite good at, that will, you know, ideally really permeate so that people understand what their rights are and when they're covered.
I sometimes like to describe you as the technocrat's technocrat, and I'm curious, given that backdrop, whether any of the sausage making of this housing deal frustrates you, because some of it is clearly born out of politics, like the fact that lawmakers could essentially veto basement apartment pilot projects in their district and some of the carve outs for when and where good cause eviction can apply, if you still call it that. So how do you react to the sausage making?
Look, I would say a couple of things. I would say that it's important to me to make sure that we are clear in what's this is true, whether it's, you know, sort of capital for nonprofits and for-profit developers who are building buildings, or whether this is tenants who live in our buildings or tenants who are uncovered. You know, having some transparency in government, I think, is great. And we really strive to do that as best as we can as a housing agency. So I you know, not all laws are written to be the most transparent, and as a result of sort of the process it takes to get there and the compromise that's required to actually get things to happen. I'm really excited that there is just so much in here for housing. I don't think I expected when we went into the process that we would necessarily come out with this number of policy tools, and it's incredible, right? I mean, to be talking, as I said before, in any given year, if we'd had half these things, we would have felt that we had a lot coming out of the budget process. So to have, you know, 15 different policy tools come out of here, and also, you know, over $500-600 million of new capital for housing. This is great, and it's our job to make sure we can get it out the door, both the information and the funding, where it's needed, which is, you know, into communities around New York State, and to make sure that the housing that's there is protected, and the housing that's not gets built timely so people can live there.
Well, there's a ton more on the housing front for us to talk about, so I hope we'll be able to hear from you soon, but that's all the time we have for this conversation. We've been speaking with New York Home and Community Renewal Commissioner Ruth Ann Visnauskas. Commissioner, I really appreciate the time, and good luck with the implementation of all this.
Happy to be with you, Dave.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a statewide union of nearly 700,000 professionals in education and healthcare.